Spirit Radio Podcasts.
You're listening to The Morning Show on Spirit Radio. Well, I can only imagine what it would be like to be a student that is waiting to start college for the first time or waiting to go into their second or third year, because there is just so much uncertainty in lots of parts of our lives right now. But education is one area where there is so much clarity needed. Imagine what it's like when you're waiting for your Leaving Cert results at the moment, and we still don't have full clarity on when the exact date colleges will open, what that's going to look like. Will students be in some days a week and distance learning other days? So I think clarity is the key word here. Well, on the line to talk to me about some of these issues, we have President of the Union of Students of Ireland, Lorna Fitzpatrick. Lorna, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Minister Simon Harris provided a little bit of clarity on start dates, but was there enough clarity needed for students in Ireland at the moment?
In a word, no. While the announcement was very much welcomed in terms of it gives us some level of clarity around the initial start date, we still don't know if the reality is going to be one day a week or one day a month on most campuses, which really means that people can't make an awful lot of decisions. And when you look at needing accommodation or whatever, you need to know if you're on campus more regularly or less frequently so that you can make a decision around that. And I suppose, like, none of us are strangers to the difficulty that there is in the accommodation sector at the moment, especially with students on a yearly basis. We have concerns around the cost. It costs people thousands upon thousands of euros for accommodation for students this year and every other year. So I'd be cautious of people signing into contracts and paying deposits on accommodation and so on that they may not need. And the problem is that they need to be able to make those decisions very quickly. And so to do that, we need that clarity.
And this is the thing, students are going to get, some students start going into first year will only get their results first week of September. They could be starting college within days, within weeks, we don't really know. And even before this pandemic, this time last year, so much of the discussion was the housing crisis for students and, you know, calls out to people saying, can you rent a room, all this sort of stuff. So what are students actually to do in this situation?
Well, that's it. And it's extremely difficult. And like last year, as you say, we would have been calling out to people asking them to rent a room and so on. But it, like we seen just at the beginning of this pandemic, where students who were living in dig style accommodation were basically kicked out because of the concern that homeowners had and the lack of protections that students in digs had. So it's a very difficult situation. And as you say, it's a very tight turnaround for especially Leaving Cert students who are receiving CAO and maybe receiving their second, waiting for their second offers or second round of offers or whatever it may be. It is going to be a very tight time frame. So I think really what we need is for the institutions to come out and give us clarity on what the reality will be for students, whether they're going to be on campus, as I say, one day a week or one day a month, so that they can make decisions around that. And we also need to see the accommodation providers, in the private market especially, to really change their approach and make sure that people have flexible accommodation opportunities. And I know institutions are looking at that at the moment. A university and institutional owned accommodation must follow that process of having that flexibility. But we're calling on the private market to do the same, because we are too reliant on the private market, and that's a massive issue. But the minister has acknowledged that now, and hopefully we will see a change moving forward. But for the immediate future, I think we need clarity, and then people will be able to make the best decision for themselves based off that.
Lorna, one thing's for sure is that college life is going to just be so different for many students, and I especially feel for first years, because it's a really exciting time. And, you know, thinking back to my college days, the first few weeks where there's loads of different events on and you're joining, you know, different groups and all that sort of stuff, and you're making new friends, and that kind of peer-to-peer interaction is so important, especially for people who have, you know, moved out of home for the first time, and there's so many different changes going on, but all that will be so different now.
Yes, and you're so right. The student experience and the overall student experience, I suppose, and going to college is about so much more than just what you get in the lecture theatres, although of course that is a big part of it. There is so much more to it, and it is joining the clubs, it's joining the societies, it's meeting people from different backgrounds, it's learning and growing as a person. And as you say, it is a very exciting time, but it can be a very anxious time for people as well. And I suppose all this uncertainty is leading to additional anxiety that's really unnecessary. I think institutions, as much as possible, need to prioritise on-campus activity. But the decisions around that need to be led by public health advice and not by financial reasons such as trying to get students in for accommodation and all those kind of things. Like these decisions need to be made, but they need to be made with public health advice first and foremost. And they do need to, and if it comes to it that we can't have the same level of club and society engagement and all that kind of thing, then they need to be supported and resourced to be able to run online or run in different and new and in innovative ways, I suppose. Because we do need to make sure that students have the opportunity to learn from each other and interact with each other and do that in a formal way, but also in an informal way, do you know?
And what about the funding packages that have, what about the funding, Lorna, that has been announced to date? Does it go far enough?
Well, look, it's obviously very welcomed. It was 168 million was announced by the minister in the reopening framework or the reopening package. 28 million of that was specifically ring fenced for student support initiatives, and they were things that we had been calling for a number of months. And so we've seen 15 million to help address the digital divide, which is a massive issue that came through from students across the board, where they're studying or they're using their phones rather than having laptops and things like that. So that will make a big difference. There was 10 million ring fence for student financial support and 8 million of that going into the student assistance fund, which will be extremely important to help support those who are really in need. Because I suppose if we look at even leaving certs, for example, who'll be coming in for the first time, many of them are under 18, and if they had been working, weren't eligible for the pandemic unemployment payment. And for students who are returning, I suppose so many of them lost employment opportunities that they would have had over the summer period. So there's an awful lot of anxiety there around the costs associated. And then there was an additional 3 million for mental health supports. And that's extremely necessary because we know the fourth wave of COVID-19 is going to be around mental health, and we need to make sure we're supporting people's mental health. So it was very welcome. But I suppose in the grand scheme of things, the estimated deficit for institutions over the 2 year period this year and over the next 2 years, 500 million. And I know there's a big difference between those two figures, but they were one of the official figures that had came out or that we can refer to. And so the 168 million, while very welcomed, doesn't meet the gap. And there's an overall funding crisis that we need to ensure we're addressing. But look, as I say, it's a welcome initiative. It's welcome funding, but I do think we need to have broader and longer conversations around the reality of a sustainable funding model.
And in terms of those broader conversations, I mean, has there been actually much connection and much consultation with those who are representing students, with student bodies from different campuses, as to what actually is needed and what might work best, whether it's from funding, but also just from a practical perspective and kind of getting the balance right and what colleges are going to look like? Because it's going to be quite some time before we probably have a vaccine. COVID is with us for the next while, unfortunately. And so education has to take a priority in what the future of Ireland looks like going forward, but is enough consultation happening?
Yeah, so to be honest, the answer around that varies, to be completely honest with you. So for example, when we look at the decision that was taken about the reopening dates, the little bit of clarity that we got there, there was no student representatives in the room when that decision was being made, which I think is really disheartening. In broader terms, we have been engaging with the department on a very regular basis, and I suppose the funding that was announced in terms of that 28 million around student support initiatives was something that we had been calling for and engaging in the conversation for quite some time on. And then I suppose when you look at the local level then, so each institution will develop their own reopening plans because they're all autonomous bodies and they're all very different in terms of space and capacity and all of those kind of things. So it's vitally important that those institutions are working with their students and students' unions on the ground to develop the best policies and best practices to be able to reopen in a safe manner. And so, to be honest, it varies, but it does need to be a priority. Because like we're the largest stakeholder, I suppose, when you look at those campuses. So making sure that we're involved and our partners in terms of those discussions and decisions is so, so important. Otherwise, things can be missed. And we bring a very different perspective to the table. So it's very important that we have have that seat.
One of the things, another perspective, Lauren, of course, is that of students and parents together. And I'm thinking of, you know, if a campus says, you know, we're only going to open one day a week or whatever it is, you know, and a lot is going to be distance learning. Are you afraid that some students are just not going to start college for different reasons? It could be that, you know, parents might be like, jeepers, like having to support this and pay for accommodation and everything. Is it worth it if you're just going to be in college one day a week, maybe defer for a year, or that people might just fall out of the education system altogether could be a worry.
Yeah, we are hearing of people who are really, really strongly considering deferrals and things like that. And I think an awful lot of that, again, comes back to the lack of clarity. And if that clarity was provided, people can make decisions. At the moment, we're trying to make decisions in the dark because we don't have that detail. And that's really unfair on parents, on students, on families. And they're trying to do their very best for the students are trying to do their very best for themselves. Their families are trying to do their very best for those students. But at the moment, they're not being helped by being given the information that they need. And I suppose whether people choose to enter or return or whatever, I think like people need to make the best decision for themselves. And I'd never say it's a good or a bad thing. It would have to, on a broad scale, it would have to be based on the individual themselves. But what I do think is unfair is that they're being forced to make decisions like this because they don't have the clarity, or being forced to make decisions or hold off on making decisions until the very last minute because they don't know what the information is or what the reopening situation will be. So I do think it's very unfair. And I do think it can be resolved by giving people the information that they need to know.
Well, finally, just to ask you, Lorna, just for students who are listening at the moment, who are in that situation where they are feeling unsure, they're a bit anxious about knowing what's around the corner for them. Where is there support? Is there places they can turn to, or what would be your advice to them?
Yeah, well, of course, they can always get in touch with ourselves or with the local students union within the institution. But to be honest, I'd say to contact the actual institution's admissions or the kind of the welcoming induction kind of offices within the institutions themselves and try and ask them for that clarity specifically. Because I think if they receive and are aware that this is such a big issue for so many people, I think it will help in terms of trying to get the message out there as quickly as possible. And I think it needs, the way in which the message is communicated out is really important as well. And we need to ensure that any messaging going out from institutions around their campus reopening or what their positions will be is very clear and very straightforward, that it's not trying to hide different things in different areas, that it's there for absolutely everybody to see so people can make those decisions.
Lorna, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That was the President of the Union of Students of Ireland, Lorna Fitzpatrick. Spirit. Well, my next guest gave a very interesting discussion recently at the Percy French Festival and also had a really interesting opinion piece in the Irish Times with the headline Progressive Views Permeate Daily Life. And on so many issues that are pressing us these days, I think a lot of you listening, maybe sometimes you have private views that publicly you're almost afraid to even debate or discuss. Is there a new orthodoxy? Is there a new thought police in town? And who is leading the charge? Well, on the line to discuss some of these issues, I have with me Maria Steen. Maria, thanks for joining us on the programme this morning.
Not at all. Good morning, Wendy. Good to talk to you.
So let's start with the Irish Times piece that you wrote recently. What was the kind of genesis? What was the reason that you wanted to write this piece?
Well, I suppose I had noticed, it's hard not to notice, the tone and the tenor of debate and so on, but also commentary, particularly in the media. And when I say the media, not only social media, but traditional media. So I had read a piece by Cathy Sheridan in the Irish Times in which she described people whom she disagrees with, predominantly in America, I think, you know, Trump supporters and so on, as conspiracists, zealots and bigots. Now, whether you think Donald Trump is an interesting man or a nice man or an effective president or not is one thing, but to call people who have different views and support him, maybe for a whole load of different reasons, you know, a zealot or a bigot, I thought was, I suppose it indicated not only what she thought of others, but also how she viewed herself. And this is quite common in traditional media, I suppose. And the thing that really, I suppose, tied it in for me was recently I watched the new FX Hulu series, Mrs. America.
Okay, so this is about Phyllis Schlafly, isn't it?
Exactly. Phyllis Schlafly was an interesting lady. So back in the 60s and 70s, there was a movement to bring in a constitutional amendment to the American Constitution, which was called the Equal Rights Amendment. On the face of it, what it said was women should have equal rights, which sounds all lovely and who would disagree with it. But actually when Phyllis Schlafly looked into it, she could see that it had very serious ramifications actually for women's rights and the privileges that they enjoyed in society at the time. And she predicted the rise of abortion and increasing divorce, which of course almost always results in poverty for women and children, the lack of choice for mothers to be able to stay at home to raise their own children, the end of single-sex schools. And she even predicted the introduction of co-ed toilets, as she called them, which we're now seeing across universities and various things around the world.
So a lot of the things she predicted actually happened. How is she portrayed in the programme?
Well, this is the interesting thing. So because she was pro-life and pro-family and so on, she's a Republican and supporter. Now, I don't necessarily agree with all her politics, but obviously on the pro-life issue, for instance, and the pro-family issue, I would certainly be at idem with her. But of course, this is not a popular view to hold nowadays. And this programme that is made, it's a big budget Hollywood program, but clearly the producers and writers and directors of the program didn't like her. And they did their best, even though she's played by Cate Blanchett, who is a very impressive actress in her own right. But clearly she portrays Phyllis Schlafly in a very unflattering light. So the script and the scenes are designed in such a way as to make her as unlikable as possible if you were in any doubt that you disagreed with her political views. So things like bedroom scenes with her husband, family conversations around the dinner table, even in the confessional with her priest, the things that she says are, you know, kind of in your mind's eye, conjure up this thoroughly unlikable person.
And is the portrayal accurate? Is it fair?
Well, this is the thing. In real life, she certainly, on the basis of the interviews that I've watched with her, she always came over as extremely ladylike, very friendly, almost with a permanent smile on her face. She was so personable, and certainly from reports of friends and family over the years, she was married to her husband for over 40 years. They had a wonderfully happy marriage. They were both mad about each other and always spoke about each other with great respect. And yet, a couple of the scenes in this program show a completely different view. But the thing that I suppose to a certain extent with any dramatization, you've got to allow a little bit of leeway to directors to dramatize somebody's life. And while you can't expect it to be accurate down to the finest detail, if you're describing the life of a real person, I think there's a certain onus that you don't stray too far from the truth. And the thing that really bothered me about it was there was one particular scene where she took part in a debate with her husband against another couple. And the other couple were on the feminist side of things and very liberal, I suppose. And during this debate, as it was portrayed on the show, Phyllis Schlafly was depicted as lying on live television and making up case law. And she was basically cross-examined by her opposite number, Brenda Feigenfasto, who called on her to cite the case. And of course, Phyllis Schlafly couldn't do this. And afterwards, it was shown her husband took her aside and upbraided her for making something up and exposing them to ridicule and so on. And I was kind of, having been involved in public debates myself, like yourself as well, Wendy, and having been accused of lying completely unfounded, because I always go in and have my homework done before I take part in any of these debates, I was surprised that Phyllis Schlafly would have left herself so vulnerable to criticism.
So what actually happened then in real life?
I actually sought out, I contacted the foundation that she set up, and I sought out the original footage of the original debate and watched it. And what actually happened was almost completely the opposite. It was her opposite number, Brenda Feigenfasto, who made up an allegation about a financial institution. And it was Phyllis's husband that called on her to substantiate what she had said and actually showed the evidence for her claim. And she couldn't do it. And she came undone under the spotlight and was basically exposed. So it was the complete opposite almost of what was actually portrayed in the show. And, you know, thinking back to Kathy Sheridan's piece where she talks about people being conspiracy theorists and extremists and all of this, I just was trying to make the point, is it any wonder that people start looking at conspiracy theories, because they're trying to make sense of why Hollywood producers and why broadcasters and why journalists would make up stuff about them and portray them in an unflattering light in a most unfair and unjust manner, where there's absolutely no backup for it. Is it any wonder that people start wondering, and why would somebody do this?
Is it a case, Maria, do you think, that we're living in a world now where we have kind of loud voices that can really take over, and they're directing an agenda, often of a kind of minority view, but they have, you know, a few kind of elitist voices decide, you know, this is a list of acceptable views, and if you stray away from it, well, you're going to be vilified.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, there was an interesting piece by Finn McRedmond in the Irish Times, I think, last week. And she was making the point that these voices which carry undue weight because of Twitter, I suppose, and also that get a hearing with the traditional media, because, of course, very many traditional media journalists and broadcasters share the views which tend to be more left-leaning. And there was another interesting case there recently. Barry Weiss, the New York Times opinion editor, resigned with a public letter, a letter to the publisher, which she made available to the public. But she basically said that, look, Twitter isn't on the masthead of the New York Times, but actually it's become its editor. And because all her colleagues had adopted the kind of behaviours and attitudes of how people converse on Twitter, which is with bad faith rather than good faith, that it became an impossibly hostile climate in which to work.
It's an interesting. I suppose, development. And I read the letter, and, you know, she just talks about how that, instead of kind of serving the people, that the paper, and I think we could say this for some of the Irish media as well, that they were, she said, beholden to a rigid orthodoxy of the so-called woke and left-leaning. Is that kind of connected up to, just finally to ask you, Maria, the talk that you gave at the Percy French Festival, where you talked about the sad demise of the moderate man? What did you mean by that?
Yeah, well, I was talking about, really, I suppose, you know, there is a sense that society has become so politicized and so polarized about everything that you're either in one camp or another, on either extreme end of a spectrum. And there is very little, you hear very few moderate voices, but also there's very little moderation. And you see, in the past, we depended on broadcasters and journalists to be that moderating influence, to be the neutral person who would moderate between two opposing or more different points of view. And that really has changed. I can't tell you the number of times that I took part in a radio or television broadcast where I ended up debating the broadcaster as well as my opponents. And where there is not that neutral ground anymore, it becomes very difficult to really hear other voices. And instead you get this predominating, kind of new orthodoxy, if you like. So that kind of loss of neutral spaces was one of the things that I was talking about, the loss of the moderating influence, but also the loss of places where people of different views and backgrounds can come together, set aside their political or religious or social views on things, and actually just enjoy each other's company and see the humanity in another person. That's becoming rarer and rarer.
Because the world is so polarized and politicized with everything,
exactly,
it seems.
Exactly. And the things that were in the past neutral places, fora, like sporting venues and cultural and social institutions, have become politicized themselves. So everybody, you know, gets on board with whatever the latest, you know, new woke social position is. And if you happen to disagree with that, when you walk into those places to socialize or to play football or whatever it is, you can't help but feel like you're other. You've got to keep your head down. You better not mention that you don't necessarily agree with everything that is, advertised. And it makes for a kind of self-censorship, I think, So,
which is a scary world to be living in. I suppose the only way we can fix it is to try and rail against ourselves, and with thoughtful pieces like the one that you have written recently. Maria, thanks so much for joining us programme this morning. That's Maria Steen there. And if you want to look up that article on the Irish Times, the headline is "Progressive Views Permeate Daily Life." Also, I definitely recommend that letter from Barry Weiss of the New York Times, her resignation letter, which is actually on her website. It's a really, really interesting read. A sad read, though, because it really does highlight the current situation we're in, just in terms of real, authentic debate and informed debate that is sadly lacking in many areas today. Spirit. Well, I do hope that you're having a good bank holiday Friday so far, and hopefully some of you will get to spend quality time over the weekend with your family, with your children. Maybe you're going to be going on a long car journey, and that can be stressful too. How do you make the most of this quality time, and what do you do when things don't go as you planned, when there's stresses and tensions? Well, we're going to be talking about that today with our next guest, psychotherapist Joanna Fortune and author of the 15 Minute Parenting book series. Joanna, thanks for joining us on the programme today. Let's start with that. We might have people even listening in the car at the moment as they're driving somewhere, which in itself can be stressful with the kind of 20 questions. Are you there yet? Are you there yet? Are you there yet? And the stress can begin before the relaxation often when it comes to going away with kids.
Yeah, and I think largely what you're trying to do is just keep everybody in the mostly happy zone, which is, you know, a good way to put what we'd call like a co-regulated space. So, I mean, car journeys can be quite stressful if you're cooped up together. You know, it's too hot, it's too cold, someone is stealing somebody's, you know, snack or encroaching on somebody's physical space in the back of the car. There's lots of things. And like you're saying, the incessant question of, are we there? I need the toilet, or what's going on? So I think kind of planning how you're going to do bursts of play in the car. And that, I'm really clear, you know, driving a car, you have to make sure you're safe and that your focus is on the road and all of that. But there are games you can play that don't require that eye contact. So think match and regulate, because then you're kind of, if they're getting on each other's nerves in the back, you can kind of go in at that heightened level and bring the temperature down. So playing games like jelly ice cream, where you say, okay, every time I say jelly, you guys have to say ice cream, but you must say it the same way that I do. So if they're kind of whinging and whining in the back, you go in with that tone of voice, do your kind of jelly, and get them to whine back at you with ice cream, and then bring it up, bring it down, bring it up, bring it down, change your tone, and then get at the end of the game rested somewhere in the middle where everybody's talking nicely to each other. So that's like a match and regulate game. You could also take turns picking everybody using the first initial of their own name, and they have to come up with five nice things about other people in the car using the first initial of their name. So it's a kind of nice, it's a twist on what is typically a mindfulness exercise, you know, to take a letter of your own name and come up with five positive affirmations that start with that letter. But this way you're giving back to those in the car. So having games that you can play in the car, and I don't mean like really prop-based things or screen-based things, but just games that you're setting the emotional tone and temperature in the car, that's going to help you a lot. And don't think, God, you know, I'm driving to Donegal from Cork. That's an epic journey. How am I going to keep playing the whole way? You don't need to. You're going to do this in bursts, because once you've had a co-regulated play, they're in their happy zone. You can have them then read a book or look out the window or set them a task of finding how many red cars, you know, between now and the next town when you say, you know, welcome to, or you're leaving, wherever. You can play a game like that, that they're on their own. And then if things are beginning to kick off or everybody's getting irritable, come in again with your burst of structured play. I just think you need to be creative. Car journeys are
tough.
And
you need to plan it, basically, really, Joanna. And it can be tough. And obviously, you've got children of different ages. What about you? I mean, you mentioned screens there, and it might be a situation where children that mightn't usually get a lot of screen time end up kind of watching a huge amount while they're in the car journey. Is it a good idea, or is it just kind of, yes, let's just accept that this is one of the realities of a long car journey?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of both. And like, I don't like to kind of bash parents over the head with, you know, don't be having your kids on screens, because I think we're already loaded with guilt about that. And I think there are special circumstances when we know as parents, we rely heavier on screen-based devices than we do other times. And it really overall is about balance. So if you're in the car journey and you know, look, I need to kick in a bit of screen time, what you don't want is that the entire journey is passed on a screen, because it might buy you peace and quiet in the moment, but that prolonged virtual cognitive stimulation, that's really kind of a lot of noise, especially if they're using headphones, which if you've a couple of kids on different devices in the car, I'm sure they are, but you've got that visual stimulus, the noise, the fast-paced movement on the screen. It might work in the moment, but when you say, we're here now, let me gather up all of those tablets, that's when you're going to have the irritability, the kickoff, the irritation, because it's very difficult. Yeah, exactly. It's very difficult for them to come out of that heightened stimulation without warning. So again, I think it's about balance. I think if you're going, okay, I really just need, you know, to sit in a bit of silence myself for 20 minutes, sure, use a screen. But then be aware, look, they've been on that 20 minutes. I'm going to take them off it. We're going to play an interactive game for 15 minutes. Then they can go back on it maybe, but that you're breaking up the length, the duration of time that they're on it. You're breaking that up with interpersonal, interactive kind of play, because that's going to offset, or at least help offset. And again, no two kids are the same. So you might be listening going, actually, my child does fine with it. They watch a movie and then they hand it over and it really is fine for us. Then it's fine. But if you know, yeah, my child really struggles when it's time to hand it over and it doesn't actually, you know, do much good for them, it makes them irritable, then you know you have to do something different.
Yeah, and the repercussions mightn't be worth it, as you say, Joanna. What about then just, I think a lot of parents build up expectations when it comes to kind of going away in a weekend, where we kind of imagine all the brilliant family time we're going to have. And because you're so looking forward to it that you kind of build up in your head, and it's no different for children as well, I imagine. But what happens when, and I know that I've made the mistake of, say, we're going to a lovely place for families and you have this expectation that your kids are going to love it and they're going to really like just be so entertained, and then that doesn't happen and you find that the expectation you put on your child was way too high. How do we kind of manage those expectations when they fall short of what we thought it was going to be?
And aren't they always going to fall short? Because it reminds me, when you were asking me that, about, you know, the whole kind of social media view of the weekend away versus the reality of the weekend away. And fantasy and reality are very different things. And sometimes, no, and this is true of children, but it is really important that we own some of this ourselves. We imagine we're all going to sing songs in the car. We're going to play funny games. We're going to get there and it's going to be all happy clappy. We'll have day trips. We'll all sit around the table nicely and eat a meal together and it'll be gorgeous. But actually, children get too hot, too cold, hungry, tired. They get overstimulated, understimulated. And that kind of physical dysregulation then triggers emotional dysregulation, which itself triggers overt behavioral challenges. So by the time your child does something, they lash out at their sibling, or they have a tantrum, or they just, whatever they do it. By the time they're doing that, you have to go, okay, I see the behavior. What is the emotional and physical state underneath it? When it comes to any of that, be you at home or a weekend away, I would say start with what you can fix really quickly. Could your child be hungry, thirsty, or tired? Go there first. Soothe the physical dysregulation. Bring them emotionally back on track with acceptance and empathy. You know, we were too long without a snack. I have snacks in the car. When I'm hungry, I get a bit ratty too. I think that's what's going on. Let's have a snack and just cool our jets. And then we'll have a think about what's going on after this. We need to take a break. Or you say, do you know what? I think you're tired. You're letting me know that you are done. You've had enough today because I've had you go to this activity or this activity or this activity and you're tired, you're done. And you've just found a great way of letting me know that. I'm hearing you. We're going home. We're going back to the room. We're going back to the hotel, whatever it is. And you actually let them know, I get you. So I think what you want to do is don't overpack your days when you're away. Ensure that there is free, unstructured time, because that's really good. And remember, when we're trying to give our kids everything, it's worth holding in mind that sometimes sitting next to you or just being with you doing nothing, that means everything.
I think that's a really important point, that we sometimes overcomplicate it and we think that they have to be, you know, totally entertained and going to, I don't know, play centres or animal farms. And actually, there's been some lovely YouTube videos I've seen over the years, you know, where they ask small children, who would you like to have with you at dinner, or what would you, and they always say mummy and daddy. You know, that's all they want. They want time with you. Is that what quality time is? Just kind of simple, undistracted time together?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, especially when our children are really little, and it doesn't disappear when they're teenagers. I know overtly our teenagers are, you know, disinterested and intensely disappointed in us, and that's developmentally appropriate. But still, just hanging out, just sitting around where you're not asking me questions, where I don't feel like you're watching me and trying to suss out what's going on, but you're just being with me. That's what we would call a true moment of meeting. And those are opportunities for shared joy. Children love that of all ages. They love just being with you. So if you were thinking of, you know, even if you're away, and I know families sometimes think, oh, I don't want to waste it. You know, we're in this area, we should see everything. Who says, you know, who says you have to see everything? You can go back another time. You could pick the top three things you're going to do and just get those three done. And you know what? If you get to do another thing, it's a bonus. But don't set yourself or your child up to fail. Bring a soft big blanket with you in the back of the car and some microwave popcorn or something that you know wherever you're going has a facility that you can use. And then you're going to sit around. You're either going to read a book together, play a board game, watch a movie, curl up under a blanket, share a bowl of popcorn, and just tell stories. Our kids love to hear about when we were little. What did we like to do? How did we like to play? What were the adventures or holidays that we had? They love those stories we share that begin with, gosh, I remember when, wait till I tell you about. They love that. And there is a secondary gain. It's not just this lovely connection with family. When our children know a lot about us and a lot about basically the family system they come from, they build a greater sense of what we call an intergenerational self. They understand they are part of something bigger than themselves, and that within their family, people have had good times and bad times, but they've overcome it together. Research would show that children who have a good sense of self and awareness of their family story are more confident, have greater independence skills, are better able to cope with, you know, those mild to moderate challenges that are inherent part of everybody's life and day. So it is, you know, keeping it simple is actually really effective. I think sometimes we dismiss basic play and basic being together like it's not fancy enough. It doesn't have enough gadgets, gizmos and props. When actually I think the complexity of play is its apparent simplicity. Simple is good. Bring some, you know, outdoor chalk, you know, the big chalk with you, and draw hopscotch, you know, bring a skipping rope. And you can actually make skipping a really challenging thing while you're away, because you could also bring some paper or, you know, party cups and fill them with water. And everybody who's taking turns jumping, if your children are a bit older now, you know, I'm thinking kind of nine into teenage, two of you turn the rope while the person in the middle jumps holding a cup of water, and you all swap, and the winner is whoever has the most water left in their cup at the end. So you bring a bit of challenge in to make something that, oh, skipping is silly, skipping's for small kids. You actually make it more engaging. But these are things that you can simply put a bit of rope, put a blanket, put a few snacks, keep it simple, and just embrace the opportunity to be together in a change of scenery.
Yeah, and a change of scenery, you're not thinking about the house and all that sort of stuff, and you're able to just spend the time.
You know, and I do think if there's loads of activities, and I think in families I hear a lot that, you know, kids want different things. Some of them like to do really active stuff and some don't. Put them into a bowl, all of the options, and everybody gets to pick one out, or put them on a list and everybody gets to pick one thing that is their must-do thing on your holiday. And that's a fair way of approaching it too.
That's really good advice, I have to say, because you are always going to have kind of different things, as you say, different personalities and all that sort of stuff. Really good advice. Thanks so much, Joanna, for joining us today. That's Joanna Fortune there, psychotherapist and author of the 15-Minute Parenting Book. And we have to congratulate her as well, because it's just been included on the Gracia UK Top 21 Parenting Books list. So make sure that you check that out.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.